one of our main hypotheses is infectious agents, but we're not ruling out any role by environmental factors.
New federal resources for the investigation into the mysterious seal illness. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, APOC finds Pebble Mine opponent Bob Gillum.
It's something APOC should never have touched. Their ruling is ridiculous, and it does set new precedent.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
TransCanada and ExxonMobil are deferring filing the next step in paperwork to get a natural gas pipeline built to the Lower 48, and they're assigning responsibility for that to Governor Sean Parnell. The companies are supposed to file draft resource reports this month on the potential Alaska Pipeline Project, or APP, but told federal authorities today that they're holding off on that. TransCanada Vice President of Alaska Development Tony Palmer says that's because in October, the governor recommended looking at a liquefied natural gas project instead.
The resource reports are complete and ready to be filed, but as you will recall, in the fall, Governor Parnell encouraged the North Slope producers to work with the APP to evaluate an LNG option.
Palmer says TransCanada and Exxon are discussing that with the North Slope producers, and so while an LNG option is on the table, they'll wait to release the resource reports. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, expected the reports this month and already planned the next step, which is scoping meetings scheduled to start January 18th in Anchorage. The Federal Coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects, Larry Pursley, says the scoping process could still go forward if TransCanada and Exxon submit the reports in early January.
Look, it's an unfortunate delay, certainly from a federal agency perspective. Everyone was looking to start reviewing those resource reports. It may only be temporary if they turn in reports in a few weeks and everyone can start reviewing the data that will be used in the environmental impact statement. There's certainly still time, not much, but there's still time to stay on schedule for a complete application to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in October 2012.
October of next year is when the companies are supposed to file their finished application, and TransCanada executive Tony Palmer says that's still the plan. He says the company is by no means giving up on a Lower 48 gas line through Canada, or the Alberta route, as Palmer calls it.
I would say that Alberta remains a viable option for us, just as the LNG does. The parties that will make that ultimate decision as to where the gas will be delivered our customers. That has always been the case. In order to succeed with a pipeline project, you need to get regulatory approvals, but you also must have commercial underpinning, which means contracts with customers.
Palmer says interest in LNG has risen because of an increase in natural gas supplies in the Lower 48 and growing overseas markets. The puzzling illness that's affecting ringed seals in the Arctic is now officially an unusual mortality event, or UME. The designation by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration will free up more federal resources to investigate the cause. Walrus have also turned up with similar lesions, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is expected to declare its own UME soon. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Diseased ring seals started turning up sick and lethargic on beaches in Barrow in mid-July. Seals with similar symptoms have been found in Russia and Canada. Canadian veterinary pathologist Stephen Rafferty is on the investigating team. He says seals with hair loss have been found for at least 8 years in Canada, but these symptoms are clearly different.
What was really striking about this unusual event is as of May and June of this past year, animals were presenting with much more severe lesions, particularly around the eyes, the nares, and within the membranes between the digits of the hind limbs.
Besides skin lesions, most of the affected seals have fluid in the lungs, white spots in the liver, and abnormal growths in the brain. Some also have small lymph nodes, a sign of a compromised immune system. To date, NOAA has documented 75 sick seals. More than 60 have died. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service found walrus near Point Lay this summer with lesions very similar to the seals. No deaths among walrus have been attributed to the lesions. All along, a virus has been considered the most likely culprit, but so far, all of the known viruses labs have tested for have come up negative.
We've screened for 18 recognized pathogens, and these have all come back negative. There are additional tests that are ongoing and results are pending.
Rafferty says some viruses are difficult to find because they invade animals, cause damage, and then disappear quickly. The investigating team thinks some kind of infectious agent is probably to blame. That could include a virus, bacteria, fungi, or parasites. But the team is also looking at chemical contaminants or even radiation poisoning.
We're not ruling out any role by environmental factors.
Harry Rolls with NOAA in Washington, D.C. is coordinating the investigation. She says the University of Alaska Fairbanks is testing for environmental factors.
A lot of the other analyses, like the chemical pollutant analysis and the radionuclide analysis, take some time to get the samples submitted, and it takes some time for analysis.
Rolls says those results should be ready early next year, but a final answer will likely take much longer, a year or more. This unusual mortality event is the 55th that has been declared since 1991. Rolls says they require long investigations, and some don't ever come up with an answer. I asked her how this event compared.
This event is going across country lines, so it's transboundary. It involves multiple species, and it is quite intriguing to try to understand what the etiology may be, and it may be a multitude of factors. So I think this one is going to be complicated. I think this one is going to take a long time to tease out all of those factors.
Rolls praises the coordination between several agencies and governments in trying to understand the event. Subsistence hunters in Alaska have also helped a lot, supplying carcasses for necropsies and information. The hunters are being told to avoid harvesting sick-looking animals. New cases of diseased seals continue to be reported, mostly from the Bering Strait area. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
A provision in an omnibus spending package passed by Congress last week bans the National Park Service from spending money on law enforcement on the Yukon River inside the Yukon-Charlie River's National Preserve. The ban, inserted by Representative Don Young, stems from conflicts between local boaters and rangers in the preserve, including the much-publicized confrontation between rangers and Central resident Jim Wild last year. The state and the Park Service disagreed about the federal agency's authority to do law enforcement on navigable waterways owned by the state of Alaska. Representative Don Young says the ban is specific to the Yukon.
It says that they can't patrol the Yukon River. They have control over the other waterways, you know, the smaller tributary streams and the Yukon-Charlie River itself, but not the Yukon.
Young had originally pushed to ban all on water law enforcement inside the Yukon-Charlie Preserve, but the agency objected, citing federal mining and subsistence fishing enforcement responsibilities. The Park Service stopped doing on-water boat safety checks this spring due to local opposition. Agency spokesman John Quinley says the new restriction will further ratchet back the Park Service's approach.
Last summer, we did not do boating enforcement, boating regulation enforcement on the Yukon River. We made contacts on shore. This, you know, we're still looking at the language and with our attorneys, but this would prohibit us from enforcing any boating regulations, safety issues, that sort of thing, and talking to people about onshore. We think we would be prohibited in enforcing those even onshore.
Quinley says the Park Service remains concerned about boat safety on the Yukon and will try to get its message out in other ways. Jim Wild is awaiting sentencing on charges stemming from the shoreside scuffle he had with rangers, which ensued after he failed to obey their orders during a boat safety check on the Yukon River in September 2010. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a facelift for an alternative high school in Sitka.
There's nothing worse than an alternative student being stuck in a traditional model.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
The House Ethics Committee has cleared Congressman Don Young of violations, but it's changing the rules to prevent the type of fundraising he did. Young received a dozen donations of $5,000 each to his legal defense fund, which were all tied to the same Louisiana businessman. The donations came from 12 different companies owned by Gary Chouest and his family. He runs Edison Chouest Offshore, a marine transportation company that has made sizable campaign contributions in the past to both Young and Senator Lisa Murkowski. If the $60,000 had come from a single source, it would have greatly exceeded the $5,000 limit on donations to legal defense funds. But the Ethics Committee found that the companies are officially different entities despite their ties. The committee said in a statement it's concerned that the incident, while legal, challenges the principles of contribution limits. So to prevent similar cases in the future, the Ethics Committee is changing the rules on January 1st. Now the owner of a company will be tied to its contributions rather than the company alone being responsible. Young has not returned requests by APRN for comment. He put out a written statement saying he is pleased that the Ethics Committee confirmed he did not violate House rules. The Alaska Public Offices Commission has issued a decision regarding their investigation into RBG Bush Plains for alleged illegal campaign contributions. The questionable contributions were made to two candidates running for seats on the Lake and Peninsula Borough Assembly in 2010. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has more.
The Alaska Public Offices Commission is fining RBG Bush Plains more than $25,000 for two alleged violations of state campaign law. APOC issued their decision on the matter late Friday. Paul Dauphiné is the executive director of APOC. He says at the heart of the investigation are plane rides provided by RBG to two candidates running for assembly seats in the Lake and Peninsula Borough.
What this boils down to is because the candidates paid less than a commercially reasonable rate for that transportation, they violated campaign laws because the same transportation at the same cost was not offered to all candidates.
RBG Bush Plains is a holding company for Robert Gillum, owner of Anchorage-based McKinley Capital Management. APOC is also fining the candidates, Michelle Ravenmoon and Nana Kalmikoff, for accepting the flights. Both were fined more than $12,000, but APOC reduced the fines to $6,700 apiece, noting the candidates' inexperience with the political and legal system. Ravenmoon of Port Allsworth and Kalmikoff of Chignik Lake were both running for borough assembly and signed forms claiming exemption for campaign disclosure reports on the basis that they expected to spend less than $5,000. Both won their seats. APOC staff alleged that RBG gave discounted services in the form of plane rides to the two candidates in September 2010, and that those services constitute in-kind contributions. APOC staff brought the complaint back in July. A decision was issued December 16th. Dauphiné says the commission is trying to ensure transparency.
The commission is working to ensure that the campaign laws and the campaign finance laws are upheld.
APOC reports say both candidates paid RBG for the cost of fuel. Ravenmoon paid $351.55, and Kalmikoff paid $1,184.60. As Dauphiné explains, APOC staff argue they should have paid the commercially reasonable value for the transportation.
They did not preclude any particular method and left the option open to the campaign to propose a rate for reimbursement that could be defended as commercially reasonable.
APOC staff says that amount should have been around $8,000. All along, RBG has argued that Ravenmoon and Kalmikoff were simply tagging along on already scheduled flights, something that's necessary for candidates who can't afford their own airplanes in rural Alaska.
In a district that's 400 miles long and you have to get around by airplane,
It's those guys who are in office and have airplanes that can campaign and nobody else can. How do you do it?
That's Art Hackney. He's with the group Alaska Wild Salmon Protection, a grassroots anti-pebble mine lobbying organization, which is closely associated with Gillum and RBG. Hackney says lawyers looked at previous APOC rulings to come up with the amount that Raven Moon and Kalmakoff paid for their flights, and he thinks APOC staff's idea of what's commercially reasonable is ridiculous.
Lawyers looked at the previous rulings, and RBG Bush Planes responsibly figured out what the cost would be, billed these ladies who were running for office, paid the amount. It's something APOC should never have touched. Their ruling is ridiculous, and it does set new precedents. And I think you're going to see that as a dialogue now that's going to bring up a serious discussion of APOC reform.
The APOC decision noted that Gillum is no stranger to the commission. Just last year, APOC filed allegations of campaign disclosure violations by Gillum and entities associated with him that were settled for a payment of $100,000. Hackney alleges Gillum is being targeted because of his support of the anti-pebble mine movement. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Petersburg will give up its legal challenge over redistricting. While they were not happy about losing their longtime legislators next year, the mayor and the majority of city councilors Monday voted not to appeal the case to the Alaska Supreme Court. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein has more.
I would like to speak against the motion. I really hate to spend another nickel on this.
Councilor Sue Flint made it plain she didn't want to continue Petersburg's legal challenge against the state redistricting board. She had several concerns.
In order for them to open this up again, they're going to have to make people who are very happy with their districts unhappy. And I just honestly can't see it happening. I know we will miss Bert Stedman, and I feel strongly like we've gone far enough with this.
The city filed its lawsuit last summer, shortly after the Alaska Redistricting Board finalized new legislative boundaries that combined Petersburg in House and Senate districts with Juneau and Skagway. Petersburg currently shares a House district with Sitka and Wrangell. Its Senate district also includes Ketchikan. Petersburg initially challenged the redistricting plan on a number of issues. The suit argued that Petersburg would have less of a voice in the legislature and had more in common socially and economically with smaller southeast cities than with Juneau. Petersburg officials this fall decided to drop those arguments and seek a summary judgment solely on the issue of whether the new district was compact as required by the state's constitution. A Superior Court judge ruled against Petersburg and in favor of the redistricting board earlier this month. Councillor Mark Jensen was one of the plaintiffs named in the suit along with the city itself. He still felt strongly about the issue Monday night, but he doubted the city would have any success with an appeal to the state Supreme Court.
We couldn't spend enough money probably to get it changed this way. I wish we wouldn't have let the other part of the appeal go, but we did. So I just want to make a statement about the social economic comparedness to us in downtown Juneau. I don't think we're anywhere. It's like apples and oranges, to make it simple. So I don't know that we should spend more money on it, but it's unfortunate, I guess is all I can say.
Petersburg spent about $30,000 on its lawsuit, and according to City Manager Steve Giesbrecht, the city's redistricting attorneys has said it would cost another $10,000 to mount an appeal. Council voted 6-1 against taking that action. Councillor John Jensen was opposed. The new districts are slated to go into effect after this legislative session. However, that could potentially be affected by an ongoing redistricting challenge that's out of Fairbanks, and it's scheduled for trial in January. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Plans to renovate Pacific High School in Sitka include classrooms with movable walls, a garden on the roof, and more common areas for students to spend time. The Sitka School District unveiled plans earlier this week for the 30-student alternative high school. The renovations are funded by money voters approved during the 2010 municipal election. As KCAW's Ed Ronco reports, school officials say the changes will not only improve the building, but also the learning that takes place inside.
Once a week, Pacific High School co-principal Phil Burdick calls everyone in the building together for a meeting.
I think we're meeting in all school.
The 30 or so students cram into one of the classrooms here where they sit on chairs or the floor or even exercise balls. Burdick stands at the front of the room with a stack of flyers announcing events, and then it's the students' turn.
All right, fun stuff. Come back from break and be ready to roll.
What?
Okay, those are opportunities. Issue. Tommy has an issue.
I think that the school should bring back hack.
Yeah.
One of the students suggests that they be allowed to play with hacky sacks in the classrooms again. Not yet, says one teacher, because one of the small beanbags hit a ceiling tile and spread dust all over his computer, but maybe after the break. Another student, senior Ricky Biggs, mentions that she saw a segment on Good Morning America the day before about a coat drive. And by the end of the meeting, the students are talking about collecting coats and other winter gear for a local charity. The all-school meeting is one of the ways Pacific High School differs from traditional schools. This is an alternative high school, a place for students who learn differently from others, a place for them to belong.
There's nothing worse than an alternative student being stuck in a traditional model. It is stifling. It is soul-numbing.
Co-principal Phil Burdick.
Students who come here and buy into the program and get excited about what they're learning about realize that they can accomplish anything.
As we walk around inside, Burdick points to water damage on the ceiling tiles. There are three square classrooms built for students to sit and listen all day, not for students to collaborate and work and move around, something the alternative education model demands. School district officials hope renovations scheduled to begin this summer will change that. The narrow hallway that cuts the building in two will disappear, replaced with an oval commons area. Classrooms will have walls that can open up to join them to each other. And the kitchen, where lunch is prepared fresh every day, will move next door to the Southeast Alaska Career Center. Students can learn cooking skills in the current kitchen and graduate with a food handler's card.
We'd like to grow the program, too. I mean, there's an entire career in tech ed strand around culinary arts. You know, right now we're staffing it with AmeriCorps volunteers, and Lauren is fabulous, but she is only one person, and she is a volunteer.
The plans for the remodel were approved by the Sitka School Board earlier this month, and also were presented to the Sitka Assembly. The city owns the school buildings, and some assembly members have been lukewarm on the idea of renovating the school. Assemblymember Terry Blake thought the amount, which works out to roughly $440 a square foot, sounded steep. And the assembly had questions about the timeline. Does this need to be done now? Bradshaw told the assembly that the district did not embark on the project lightly.
Believe me, I understand what $2.2 million is. But that's why we took it to the taxpayers of this community, was to say, are you willing to spend this? The taxpayer said, yes, we're willing to spend this, and we're willing to back it.
Back at Pacific High School, co-principal Phil Burdick says $2.2 million is a small amount to improve a program that he believes ultimately helps the taxpayers.
Our students stay in Sitka. They get a better job. They pay more taxes. If we have high school dropouts who can't get a job and have to be on welfare, then they pull from the tax roll.
Let's go back to Ricky Biggs, the student who wanted to start the coat drive. She says the renovation has been in discussion since she was a freshman.
And we talked about it for a really long time, and none of us thought it was going to happen. Like, I'm a senior now.
The students wrote letters to politicians, talked with architects about what they wanted to see in the new school, and then hoped that it would actually happen. And now that it is?
It's pretty awesome. I'm happy. Even though I'm not going to be here, I'm really happy that it's happening.
Bids on the Pacific High School renovation are scheduled to go out in the spring, with work to begin soon after. The hope is that the work will be done by this time next year. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Volunteers in Bethel raised nearly $2,000 selling Christmas cookies. Proceeds are going to a swimming pool fund, something their group, the YK Lifesavers, has been after for 18 years. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Mark Earhart has the story.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The cookie extravaganza started with a countdown as a few dozen people lined up by the door. Hours before, volunteers had begun stacking cookies of all shapes and sizes on platters resembling everything from Christmas trees to snowflakes.
25 to 30 bakers that donate lots of pounds of their favorite Christmas cookies, and it's become such a fun event over the years, and it's a great fundraiser for the swimming pool.
Bev Hoffman, the coordinator of the Christmas cookie extravaganza, said that she and the other volunteers had been baking cookies for 18 years with one goal in mind, a place for area children and adults to learn to swim.
This community and the nearby communities around us will absolutely gain from having a place that families can go and that children can learn how to swim. And this is just one mechanism to support the effort of making that a reality.
Hoffman said that the YK Lifesavers, the group that hosts the event, was started because of growing concern in the community.
It was mostly a group of mothers and other concerned people over the deaths by drowning in this area.
For years, the community of Bethel has lobbied for a pool. A portion of city taxes has even been set aside to help fund the construction of one, known as the Bethel Aquatic Training Health Center, or BATH for short. It has often been one of the top priorities for the Bethel City Council when asking for state funds.
I think this year our representatives are going to really pursue funding for it.
But it all started with baked goods, more often than not shaped like ornaments and reindeer. Hoffman and the rest of the Lifesavers have raised over $155,000 over the years selling cookies by the pound. Many walked out of this year's event with over 3 pounds in tow. Jesse Klaka, a local high school student volunteering for the National Honor Society, said that the event was not taken lightly in the community.
I know my mom really takes it seriously because she gave me $40 for all the cookies. She said, make sure you buy them before anyone gets here.
In just 14 minutes, most of the cookies were snatched up and well on their way out the door. Hoffman and other Lifesavers, though, stayed to clean up and dream about the day their goal is finally realized. For KYUK, I'm Mark Earhart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Mark Earhart in Bethel. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by ConocoPhillips Alaska and Mattsu Health Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.